The Mario Rosenstock Podcast. Thanks to Home. Finance made easy when you shop tech, electrical, appliances, kitchens, and much more. Flexify Europe Limited, trading as Home, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.
Coming up on this episode of the Mario Rosenstock Podcast.
If somebody is caught with drugs, what benefit to society is giving them a criminal record? And to go back to Leo Varadkar, if Leo had been unlucky enough during his student days to be busted, he would never have been a doctor. He might have become Taoiseach, possibly. I doubt it. But he wouldn't have been allowed to go to America to meet the president on Paddy's Day. He couldn't have gone to Japan to meet the Japanese Prime Minister. But he got away with it. And that's why if you do, as a politician, say, I tried drugs, yep, whatever, and then you're not supporting decriminalisation, I think there's actually a gross hypocrisy there.
If there's one publication that's never been afraid to ask difficult questions about drugs, it's Hot Press. For decades, politicians sitting down for a Hot Press interview knew there was every chance that they'd be asked a question a lot of journalists wouldn't touch, namely, have you ever taken drugs? Sometimes the answers were honest, sometimes they were wonderfully evasive, but the conversations helped bring an often taboo issue into the public domain. At the same time, Hot Press has consistently argued that treating drug use primarily as a criminal issue simply isn't working. And rather, Ireland should focus on policies centred on public health, education and harm reduction. Now, these conversations continue in a Hot Press podcast called Dealing with Drugs. It's presented by a deputy editor of Hot Press, Stuart Clark, who joins me as my special guest on this episode of the Mario Rosenstock podcast. We chat about everything from why Portugal's model of decriminalisation is working and why Ireland's model of criminalisation isn't, to organised crime, music culture, and why honesty may be the most important starting point for any meaningful debate about this hugely important issue.
And I think of a 14 or 15 year old kid who may have had a shag on E and it's the best thing they've ever had. You're going, oh no, E will kill you, don't take drugs. They're going to go, granddad, don't be so stupid. If you're being honest about drugs can be okay, when you start talking about when they're not okay, people actually might believe you. I shouldn't get excited by this, but narco submarines. They build their own submarines that can travel halfway around the world. These cartels have more money in the coffers than most African countries. The synthesis that happens when you drink and take cocaine,
yes,
it secretes a certain substance. And this proverbial ticking time bomb is actually real. So once you've done that damage, you're sitting there going, right, I'm doing me marathon. I'm going to the gym four times a week, but I can still have a heart attack. Would you rather someone takes drugs down an alleyway,
yes,
littered with human feces,
yeah,
who could overdose and die,
yeah,
or be in a nice safe injecting room with a nurse? And actually, if you're in the mood that day to see some experts or get some help or get a medical checkup, you walk through a door, there's the doctor.
My full chat with my old buddy Stuart Clark of Hot Press coming up in just a couple of minutes' time. But first, this week, I recorded what has turned out to be the most popular gift grub sketch in years, receiving over 2 million views in 2 days. Of course, it had to be about the World Cup. But something I thought of this week was that some of the English players have come from Irish backgrounds, namely Harry Kane, Declan Rice. Jack Grealish was another member of the squad that had come into the squad before. And even in years gone by, Wayne Rooney. And even Jude Bellingham apparently carries an Irish passport, would you believe? And this led me to get into my best Bob Dylan impression and do this.
England beat Mexico 3-2, but some of them dudes looked Irish, more than a few. England shouldn't have been there, could have been Ireland instead, cause up front they had a man with a big Irish head. Here comes the story about Harry Kane, the English football team they like to claim, but Harry's dad's from Letterfrack. We could have had him in attack, and we could have been the champion of the world. Hmm. Yes, they took Jack Grealish and that wasn't nice. But they needed more Irish, so they took Declan Rice. England's team is full of paddies, that's why they're rated so highly. God damn it, even this centre back is called O'Reilly. That son of a gun at the back, yeah, he's on fire. Replaced another Irishman, Maguire. Just think what we might have done. With all them boys, we might have one time become the champions of the world. Last chance for Ireland in the World Cup quarterfinal. Keegan Kelleher, it's a Harry Kane. Dry powder! Wayne Rooney, he was Irish, and so was Morrissey too. The Gallagher brothers are from Mayo, they're Irish through and through. England, get your own team, let Ireland play. Throw in Pico Lopez, and it's ole, ole, ole. There was the story about Harry Kane, the English football team they like to claim. But Harry's dad's from Letterfrack. Oh, we could have used him in attack, and we could have been the champions of the world.
And brand new comedy every week on the Mario Rosenstock podcast. That sketch, of course, first received its outing on the Ian Dempsey Breakfast Show just last week. I think it went out on Wednesday last week on the Ian Dempsey Breakfast Show, and I repeat it here today for you on the Mario Rosenstock podcast. And of course, my thanks to Hum for partnering up with the Mario Rosenstock podcast. Hum is a finance company who provide flexible payment solutions for customers, some of Ireland's most popular retailers. They can help you make your purchases and pay back in bite-size, easy payments. It couldn't be easier. Festival season is here, folks, and if you're in the market for tents, outdoor speakers, tech, fitness gear, anything you'd like to get you all set up, Hum has you covered. Thank you, Hum, for getting involved not only in podcasting, but partnering up with the Mario Rosenstock podcast. Okay, so let's meet my special guest on this episode, Stuart Clark, Deputy Editor of Hot Press. As I mentioned at the top of the show, Hot Press has an amazing ability to get politicians to open up about whether or not they have sampled a joint or something more in the past. So I started by asking Stuart about that. Hi, Stuart. Welcome to Mario Rosenstock's podcast. You're on today to talk about a very interesting podcast and worth talking about. And we're going to do that in a minute. It's called Dealing with Drugs. And we'll go into that in a minute. But first of all, I wanted to talk to you about Hot Press and drugs.
Yes.
Because Hot Press has a very interesting relationship with its interviewees and drugs, particularly its political interviewees. I mean, let's do a kind of a sweep of that. I mean, all the politicians, the Taoiseach, for example, have been interviewed at one stage or another by Hot Press. Even Charles Haughey, I remember going back, interviewed by Hot Press, made quite a controversial interview with Hot Press. And all the Taoiseach since then have been interviewed. And at one stage or another, they're always asked, have you ever taken drugs?
It's a stock question. And some of the wonderfully evasive answers, which go on for 5 minutes and don't say yes or no, are spectacular too. But yeah, I just had a quick look through the back pages. Well, Gino Kenny wasn't a huge surprise. Catherine Murphy, Nessa Hourigan, formerly of the Greens. Brian Cowan was actually a very senior politician when he said he did inhale. And
Brian Cowan said he would have been in university, presumably.
I think quite early on in his sort of fledgling political career, could have been university. University was definitely the setting for Leo Varadkar.
Yeah.
And I admired his honesty, and I admire people's honesty for telling the truth and not evading questions. But it did haunt him. In the 2020 election cycle, it came up and was made an issue. And he was sweating on the top line because there are still people who think, oh, you're a druggie. Even it's like Leo Varadkar, who patently doesn't sort of fit that stereotype. But that is another point.
What did he say?
That he had taken cannabis at college, but it had no further adventures with drugs and certainly hadn't progressed onto other harder substances. But that is interesting because people do have this stock image of somebody who uses drugs. And of course, everybody uses drugs.
But they want, it's a funny question to have to answer as a politician, because in one respect, you want to avoid the legal damage that could be done to yourself and the reputational damage. But on the other respect, you want to show your electorate that you have a certain kudos as well and that you're cool enough to go, yeah, you know, I was cool as well in my time.
It's a real catch-22, and for musicians and people in the arts now, they were a lot more open a couple of years ago, but now with Trump's America, you say you've taken drugs 30 years ago. I think Nigella Lawson admitted to historic cocaine use, going back decades, and suddenly couldn't get a visa. And there's no written down criteria. It's not a case of a prosecution anymore. If you allude to taking drugs, you stand a very good chance of not getting into the States. So musicians who'd like to talk about it, not just to regale us with Lemmy-like tales of excess, which are great fun, they might want to sort of campaign and campaign for compassionate sort of drug policy. They might feel that people are dying and being criminalized for the wrong reasons, but they're keeping their mouth shut because those visas to the States are just, that's their career gone if they're withdrawn.
But it's a funny thing as well, because, and this goes to all areas of life. If a politician says they took drugs, they're held to account. Yet if a rock star admits to taking Class A drugs and being strung out on heroin for 20 years, it just washes over people. Now, you can say that they're not electorally responsible and that they're not democratically elected. But at the same time, if a children's breakfast show presenter says, I took drugs in the 80s, they're gone as well. But the rock star isn't.
No, it's
and I suppose
true.
You could argue, oh, well, that's because he worked with the BBC, and the BBC are answerable to the public, of course. But no, if the BBC, if a children's breakfast show on ITV fella did it, he'd be gone as well. So there is an unspoken line here. What is the line?
I think with politicians, it's fairly clear if they're affecting policy.
But do you remember, was it Richard Bacon?
Yes. Do you know, my mother had her whole life shattered years ago. Remember Frank Boff?
Yes, of course.
Who was the ultimate safe, you know, sports presenter.
Yeah.
Lovely cardigans.
One of the characters on who Alan Partridge is based on.
Absolutely.
David Coleman and Frank Boff.
See him and his wife having wholesome walks in the countryside. Then Frank was caught, I think, wearing women's suspenders, snorting cocaine off of porn modelled breasts.
Was he?
I think so. Yeah. He's dead now, so I can say that.
Yeah.
But no, and my mother was just like, is nothing sacred? That even the safest pair of hands on British TV.
Yes.
That just goes to show. It was fascinating when we had legal highs and there were shops on the high street.
The head drugs.
Yeah, all of those. And I stood outside a few times. And a doctor friend of mine sat in his car because he wanted to see who was going in. And he expected, you know, scruffy urchins and long-haired rock journalists and maybe national radio broadcasters to be going in to get their legal highs for the weekend. But it was mums and blokes in their 70s. And he said, you know, I saw this. All forms of human life were there. And when I was in Portugal a few years back, and we'll That's talk right. about this, they had a mobile injecting room where you could inject and get your methadone and everything. And we were permitted to just hide around the corner for an hour. And some of the people who stopped in their cars and went up to get their methadone, you would never in a million years have said they're a drug user. So that whole 2 or 3 years where legal highs were legal was very instructive. And also it was a lesson in how you could control the drug trade and try and reduce the harms. But, you know, it was an open goal for politicians. Mm. It was working quite well. Mm. They were paying VAT. The tax take was coming in. That money was going to the health service. But they couldn't be seen to be weak on crime. Mm. So, of course, they banned it. And we went backwards to this current awful fudge we have in this country. That's what we do. We fudge things here. It's sort of like we're not trying to send you to jail, but we will do.
Mm. Okay. Tell me about the name of your podcast and what the intention of this podcast is.
Well, dealing with drugs is an obvious pun. We nearly went for Hot Press on drugs or Stuart Clark on drugs, but we thought for the international market. It's obviously serious and we want to talk about policy because too many people are dying from drugs. But as Bill Hicks said, you never hear the positive drug stories.
Yeah.
And in saying to somebody, you'll smoke a joint and within a month, your whole life will be ruined. You'll be like sleeping rough and no one wants to know you. That's rubbish because people have good experiences. I think the only drug where you don't tend to have people getting dewy-eyed with nostalgia is heroin.
Mm.
And Lemmy's one of my barometers when it comes to drug taking. Lemmy said, it's a fool's drug. It can take control of you, as indeed can methamphetamine and crack cocaine and fentanyl. But, you know, he had 80 years of thoroughly enjoying his drug taking and some of his best moments, you know, had drugs involved. So if you're being honest about drugs can be okay, when you start talking about when they're not okay, people actually might believe you.
Mm.
And I think of a 14 or 15 year old kid who may have had a shag on E and it's the best thing they've ever had. You're going, oh, no, E will kill you. Don't take drugs. They're going to go, granddad, don't be so stupid. So when you warn them about a rogue batch of pills or fentanyl being so, so strong you can overdose, or GHB, you can kill yourself by having a few milliliters too much of it, they don't believe you. And I think, so you've just got to be honest and just tell people the facts and let them then make their own minds up.
Okay. Am I right in saying that Hot Press has campaigned for years for the partial decriminalisation?
Well, the full decrim. I mean...
Full decrim.
Full decrim. Look, I think there is a case to be made...
When you say full decrim, let's talk, get down to brass tacks. What does that mean?
Well, literally. Of the personal user. I think there's an argument to be made for legalising a lot of drugs and regulating them, but realistically, you're not going to get any Western government doing that. And I want people to stop dying in this country and other countries. So let's look at what legislators might be willing to do.
Okay.
In an Irish context now, the Greens and the Social Democrats are very clear, and People Before Profit, we decriminalise. Now, they're not going to be the main government partners, but maybe, just maybe, they could be coalition partners. And maybe, just maybe, that could be the red line. It could be that in the UK, the Green Party.
Would it be fair to say that it's unlikely that Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil would allow that line to be gone over?
It depends how strongly the party feel. With the Greens, it was always going to be the environment. With the Social Democrats, I'm not quite so sure. With the Greens in the UK, they really have nailed their colours to that sort of mast, and they're making it. What I'd like to see is those parties, the Greens, the Social Democrats, People Before Profit, making it a real election issue and focusing on the people who are criminalised wrongly, who are dying where they don't need to, the families, and what we could do to improve the situation. I think one of the problems with drug policy is if you're not personally affected, you don't really care either way. And that's not because you're being horrible, but if you haven't seen what heroin can do to somebody or you haven't experienced it, it's not something that particularly affects you. I mean, there are some parts of Dublin where, you know, I could walk now, you see drug deals, you see crack pipes being smoked, you'll see intravenous injection. Then it does affect you, and maybe then you'd be more likely to engage. But the average person doesn't really see drug taking, doesn't feel it's a particularly big issue compared to the environment or the economy or whatever.
Can you paint for me a world? What does it look like when this kind of decriminalisation is put into action? What does taking drugs look like in this world?
Well, I can give you a really good example of the most mature in terms of years and also approach. Decriminalisation model introduced in 2001 in Portugal.
Yes.
By quite a conservative government. But they had drug ghettos. They were having 373 drug-related deaths every year. That's a population of 15 million. And they didn't know what else to do. So they went the radical route of decriminalising personal use.
And personal use of all Class A drugs.
All drugs across the board. And personal use does have criteria, but it's quite generous. I can't remember exactly, but it could be like 10 or 15 grams of cannabis.
But just to kind of be nickety about this, if I want to, let's say I'm a heroin user.
Yeah.
And I read that it's decriminalised. I still have to buy that heroin illegally.
It is. You could say it's the ultimate fudge, but it works. What's interesting, I was across there on a fact-finding mission. With a former assistant Garda commissioner, Jack Nolan, who at first was like, this is all nonsense. And by the end of it, Jack was going, this is the way to go.
Right.
But I'd expect that kind of sane thinking from an Everton supporter.
Okay.
You know, you can tell Jack's a man of intellect. But so it sounds a bit of a fudge. But what they do is, instead of you being hauled off to court, cost I don't know how many thousands of pounds or euro, you go to a dissuasion committee. You sit down with four experts. And they say to you, you know, why do you take drugs? And if you go, I like them, they go, okay, well, off you go. Fair enough. Yeah. But if you go, well, look, I can't get a place in university. You know, I can't read. I can't get a flat. I've got mental health difficulties. They literally have a phone book and say, okay, we'll set you up with a education expert. Not next month or the month after, tomorrow. And they try and rebuild your life doing that. They try and get people to go with them, wanting to work with them. And since they introduced this, the number of problem drug users has halved to 50,000. HIV cases have plummeted from 60% to 6%. Mm-hmm. Heroin use among prison population was 14%, now 3%. Mm. These drug tent cities have disappeared. Mm. People don't get criminal records. So when they do sort themselves out, they can better look after themselves
and progress
and their families. Mm. This dissuasion committee is half the cost of taking somebody to court, and the outcomes are far better. Mm. And the millions saved every year go directly into health and awareness. And kids of 9 and 10 and 11 are being told about drugs in an appropriate way. Mm-hmm. So it's been going for 25 years. Mm. It is working. Mm. We have around, I think, 330 drug-related deaths a year. Mm. We are half the population of Portugal, so they would have 7 or 8. Yeah. So, I mean, in a way, for me, that's where the debate ends. So we shouldn't have to say anything more about
it. Right. So your argument in this case is that that 25-year statistic is acting as an empirical study from one of our European neighbours.
Well, that a country this work, that's quite analogous because they're quite conservative, yeah, quite Catholic and religious.
Yes.
It's a very good comparison. And a lot of there's a coterie of prohibitionist doctors who are reefer madness, this crazy just say no war on drugs. And they would say, oh, well, if you decrim it, it's the back door to legalization. But Portugal doesn't want to change it. Mm. I've talked to cops and politicians, people on the dissuasion committees. They're going, look, it's imperfect and a bit of a fudge, but it's a perfect fudge in the way that it's reduced these drug deaths.
Excuse me, sorry for asking a question like I'm a two-year-old. Tell me like I'm a two-year-old. What is the precise difference between decriminalization and legalization?
Well, legalization means that we could open Drugs R Us,
yes,
on O'Connell Street,
okay,
and sell anything. And the Mr. Biggs can bring in their bales of marijuana. So
we could advertise on the radio, presumably.
Exactly.
Hurry, hurry, hurry!
I think the Ian Dempsey Breakfast Show could be a perfect vehicle for them. But this way, the importers, exporters remain illegal. And we've other examples. You know, Malta now allow you to grow up to, I think, half a dozen cannabis plants. You can only buy it through a non-for-profit cooperative. There are various models that have taken bits of Portugal, but Portugal is the biggest umbrella for decrim.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Jack Nolan, who was a man who'd never been soft on crime,
right,
it is
got his head was
30
turned.
Plus years. Mm. Went across and started talking to his counterparts from the three different Portuguese police forces. I don't quite know how it works over there, but it's three different forces. And they're all saying it works. And I remember a few years back, there was a big furore about introducing a safe injecting room at Merchants Quay. Mm. And they brought across Pat Perroz, who had worked in the serious crime squad in Australia. He was a hard bastard, very nice man, but I mean, you know, and Pat said everything that, you know, it stood for, I was against the idea you'd have these people taking drugs coming into a neighborhood, but everything I thought was wrong. Mm. And it's a wonderful public resource, and where they have safe injecting rooms around the world, they're now seen as a civic resource. And even if you don't like the people using them, isn't it best they're in that room rather than taking drugs in front of your children? I think the compassion should be, would you rather someone takes drugs down an alleyway,
yes,
littered with human feces,
yeah,
who could overdose and die, or be in a nice safe injecting room with a nurse, and actually if you're in the mood that day to see some experts or get some help or get a medical checkup, you walk through a door, there's the doctor.
Yeah. How bad do you think, right, is Ireland's drug problem now?
I don't think any number of deaths is okay. Realistically, you're always going to have them, but it's got to be in the teens, not in the hundreds. And the fact of the matter is, we throw so many resources at trying to get tough on drugs and all this kind of crap,
yeah,
and it never changes. The death rate never plummets. You know, on the podcast, we talk about the biggest interception of cocaine in the history of the state, $160 million worth of cocaine, the MV Matthews. Mm-hmm. There was no drought. You know, cocaine prices didn't suddenly quadruple because for every boat that gets stopped and is on the news and the guard get all like pleased with themselves, it's probably 15 or 16 consignments getting through. Mm. So what we're saying is the war on drugs is a lovely idea. It's been lost. Yeah. This isn't working. So let's change it. But also, I think, you know, obviously with hot press, drugs have always been a part of popular culture. You look at every musical movement, it was driven by one drug or the other. Mm. The Doors, LSD, punk, amphetamine sulfate, Duran Duran. I'm not saying the individual members of the band, but New Romantic was driven by cocaine.
You too, Jesus.
Absolutely, God, which you could say is an addiction, an unfortunate one. Then you had, you know, the whole acid house thing was ecstasy and, you know, go on. So
The Rolling Stones, the more I think about it, the more you analyse this, the Rolling Stones seem to now have given up drugs in about 1863.
Yes.
Because the more you talk about it, the longer it is that they've taken drugs. And now it seems that it's actually the 19th century that Mick Jagger and Keith Richards were doing drugs. I think it was opium in Victorian Den he was last taking drugs.
I know.
So long ago now.
They were quite particular about the quality of their drugs. They were sort of connoisseurs. Interesting, we had Irvin Welsh on, and Irvin is always...
Yeah, okay, Irvin Welsh, so train spotting.
And talking about the train spotting lads, 30 years on, Men in Love. And he argued, and at first I thought, this is a bit, you know, off on a tangent, that the biggest addiction problem we have is social media. Mm. And I've thought about that now for a couple of months, and he's absolutely right, because it is an addiction. We've seen court cases in America. Yeah. Kids in particular are going down rabbit holes through their addiction to social media. And in many cases, becoming radicalized. Most of the people who are committing awful kind of crimes, knife crime, you know, shootings, you can go back to some form of radicalization. Yeah. It sometimes happens.
Like gambling as well.
Yeah.
It is a dopamine releaser.
It is.
Right. That is untraceable. You can't see
absolutely.
Evidence of it.
Yeah.
So you are silently becoming addicted, and you are silently possibly committing felonies because of it, because nobody can tell.
And I think it's really good to broaden that debate out to include all sorts of things that are potentially bad for you and what we can do to alleviate that. We've also, you know, had some fascinating conversations. I spoke to
How long has it been going?
We're on episode 5.
Episode 5. And is this about Ukraine or about Poland or about Palestine?
Those and others. We were talking...
I found it very interesting, the notes about Ukraine. I mean, for example... First of all, the tragedy that Ukraine has disappeared from our news. All right?
Yeah.
So not only has Ukraine disappeared from our news, but Palestine has disappeared from our news. Hezbollah has practically disappeared from our news. Now we're all talking about Iran. This two-week news cycle that we constantly go through means one is replaced by the other. And one of the things that came up in your things about overlooked is the chronic drug abuse on the front lines in the Ukraine war.
My understanding is there's no sort of battleground counselling.
Would there be?
Exactly. But what you do have about 100 yards behind the front line are drug dealers.
Jesus.
And obviously you've got
for both sides, or possibly mutually.
Well, my understanding is there's a problem with the Russians as well. And Putin has just outlawed any form of harm reduction. So you've got all these people, I mean, with either mental and or physical scars. What's going to happen? The Russians are just sticking their fingers in their ear, whereas the Ukrainians are furiously commissioning, and there's been Irish involvement in trying to put together models, because obviously you're going to have tens of thousands with PTSD. And one of the things you do is turn to drugs. I was talking to a lady in Beirut the other day, Tatiana Schliemann, from the Schoon Lebanese Addiction Centre. And it was very poignant. It took us hours to get through on WhatsApp, and we eventually got through.
All right.
And I was talking to her, and you could hear thuds in the background. And I said, what are those thuds? Oh, they're bombs. And she was telling me that, you know, three of her colleagues got the five-minute warnings. You're meant to get an hour, but you suddenly get your phone pings, or it's on the internet. Here's where we're going to bomb. You have 5 minutes to leave. And you have your whole life, your pet parrot, your dog, everything. What sort of choices do you make in 5 minutes? I suppose you probably just run for it. And she was saying that...
Blaze up.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. Geez, I don't know if I would... And I would worry about the dog.
Yeah.
Maybe the wife. But, you know, 40% of the people using her services are now homeless. And you realise that, you know... Again, you talk about Palestine... When I was in the Lebanon, the Palestinian refugee camps in the Lebanon, we think they're going to be tents. But of course, they're not. They've been there since 1948. They're de facto cities of 150,000 people. but they're not full Lebanese citizens. So they can barely work legally. They can't leave. They're in open prison. And methamphetamine use is rife in those camps. And a lot of families encourage their kids to go into the trade to make some money. There is a suggestion, which they have denied, and I hope they won't sue us, that Hezbollah are major players in the methamphetamine trade to raise money. And indeed, several labs have been found in areas that appear to be controlled by Hezbollah. Mm. They strenuously deny that. So, you know, again, if you're being bombed back to the Stone Age and someone's got methamphetamine or heroin, I mean, there's a good chance you're going to take it. And you can't really sort of, you know, have a moral judgment about that. I mean, I'd be doing the same if I was being bombed every day.
I wrote down a note there when you talked about drugs and war in Ukraine and everything. I mean, drugs and war go all the way back to the beginning of wars. I mean, I remember reading about, you know, even the Nazis putting the when they went through the Ardennes at the beginning of World War II, you know, they were all on this thing called Pervitin.
Yeah.
And then the even in World War I, how do they get the guys to go over the top? E.
Absolutely.
It was E, wasn't it? It was MDMA. They were on MDMA in 1914 and 15.
And ketamine goes back to the year dot as well. I mean, people think that, you know, ketamine's a new thing, but yeah, it was a battleground anesthetic, probably back to the First World War.
Right.
One thing that is recurring is the huge damage done across the board by Donald Trump and Robert F. Kennedy and Elon Musk, you know, and his chainsaw. Like, you know...
Well, they've just stripped down the CDC.
Everything.
They've eliminated experts. They've gotten rid of scientists, fired scientists, put in kooks. Mm. I mean, Dr. Oz himself is just a TV evangelist, basically. Trump blowing boats out of the water with Secretary of War. And they're not even on their way to America, those boats.
Strangely, though, with Trump, he's reclassified cannabis to be less serious, which might mean we won't get people in jail for 35 years for three strikes and you're out for marijuana. There are still prisoners serving life sentences purely for personal possession of marijuana. But he's also very pro-hallucinogenics. Mm. I say he's on them half the time, possibly. But he wants to see, because hallucinogens can be used to treat PTSD, a whole range of things, alcoholism. I did a bit of work with a company a few years ago, and it looks really promising. So it's a very interesting area that was actually being explored in the 60s in America. I found out that Andy Williams had marriage guidance counselling on LSD.
Yeah.
But then
Gary Grant was a huge LSD taker.
That's it. But then Nixon came in with the war on drugs and just say no, and anything like that was just cut. So actually the medicinal benefits of everything from marijuana to psilocybin or whatever, you know, it was arrested for 30 or 40 years because scientists couldn't, do the number crunching and the research. But now we're going to see, I think, some major advances medically. And we tease that out in the show. That's a subject we've come to.
Robert Kennedy was a heroin addict for 14 years, as he admits himself.
I've asked people, can they unpick Kennedy? And nobody can. I mean, he is just the most incredible enigma. More so, in a way, I think, than Trump. I think I can work Trump out.
Mm.
But Kennedy is just weird. Another thing which I find fascinating, we spoke to Noel Brown, who is the now retired, the Gardaí's liaison officer in Colombia for 7 years. And he was instrumental in that seizure of 160 million euros worth of cocaine as it neared the Irish coast.
Mm.
And he was telling me about the technology.
Mm.
And I shouldn't get excited by this, but narco submarines.
Mm.
They build their own submarines that can travel halfway around the world. These cartels have more money in the coffers than most African countries. And the way they've got their own satellites, and I mean, all sorts of incredible stuff.
Well, Kinahan Cartel is a multi-billion dollar company.
Absolutely. And there are narco states in Africa, only one or two, where the economy is so interlinked with drug smuggling that if you were to stop the smuggling, the country would absolutely collapse.
Yeah.
It's so embedded in the economic sort of model. Mm. So we have such a broad range of people. I always find it interesting to talk to former top cops who just wanted to lock people up and arrest these degenerates. A guy like Jason Q, who worked for Thames Valley Police, was very high up. And again, he just went, why am I arresting these people for something that's not harmful to anybody apart from them?
Mm.
And there's nothing like a born-again law enforcement person. Because I think, you know, people listen to me and go, oh, he's a rock journalist, works for Hot Press, you know, great, you know, whatever. But a policeman saying, you know what, this doesn't work. And Jason has turned now into a campaigner for decriminalisation, harm reduction, and has just succeeded in getting state funding in the UK for safer inhalation pipes for crack users. And this is going to save lives. So I'm hoping that, you know, in Ireland now, we can make this an electoral issue. We're going to be doing everything we can over the next year or two to see if we can bring it out more and more into the mainstream. But it's an uphill task.
It strikes me that even just visually on the streets of Dublin, it's as, let's say, as obvious as it's ever been, isn't it?
Yeah, it's awful. But I used to get shocked by seeing somebody injecting between their toes. Mm. I'm not immune to it. And I go, oh, but it's not shocking in the same way. Mm. So I see it all the time. The crack pipe use. Again, at first you're going, my God, someone's smoking crack. But now, I remember a few years ago, my co-host is a wonderful guy called Tony Duffin.
Mm-hmm.
Was the CEO of the Anne Liffey Drug Project in Dublin for a number of years, and brought about one of the major innovations. And we find this difficult with the show, and I'll explain why in a second. I think the best practice these days within an organisation, and Anne Liffey are doing this, is to have at every level people with lived and living experience. Now, obviously, if it's living experience, you have to work out parameters and employment contracts, that kind of a thing. Lived experience, a little easier to deal with. But if you're talking to people with living experience, you want to hear the realities of what's going on. And if you talk to people who use drugs, you realize they're somebody's brother or uncle or auntie, that they have a story. They're nice people, the majority of them, you know, and they want to be heard. But obviously, as a media person, you don't want to take advantage of somebody. Mm. And, you know, can they give their consent to being identified? So there's a whole ethical issue there. We would like more people on the podcast with living experience. And I think in terms of the debate, that's how we can move things on here. But it does come with sort of dangers.
Ireland is overrun by cocaine at the moment.
Yes.
I mean, there was a lot of talk about that in the Celtic Tiger years, but it's I think it's even worse now because because of the price of everything, the cost of living in Ireland, the cost that it takes to go out and get drunk, to buy drink, that people now are just getting loaded up on cocaine before they go out.
Every publican I know says their bar take has gone down and down and down.
Yeah, and that's not just because people are giving up alcohol, it's because they're transferred to cocaine.
Absolutely. That is happening
a lot. But cocaine is one of the most fucking disgusting drugs in terms of the way it makes people, the kind of community it creates when people are on cocaine, and also the long-term psychological effects are awful.
This is where being honest about drugs is a good idea, because people go, oh, you know, you take a line of coke, you're going to die. No, you probably won't do. But I didn't know until recently the synthesis that happens when you drink and take cocaine.
Yes.
And that does not, like, if you take heroin and you stop taking it, you can probably recover and live a full and normal life until you're 80. But cocaine and alcohol, I'm not a doctor, it secretes a certain substance. And this proverbial ticking time bomb is actually real. So once you've done that damage, you're sitting there going, right, I'm doing me marathon. I'm going to the gym four times a week, but I can still have a heart attack. So I think, you know, that's why being honest about drugs, you know, to be able to say, if you're going out taking cocaine, ease up on the alcohol.
Can you see a situation, can it be not scientifically, but from your looking at it, if I said Ireland is overrun by cocaine, if you decriminalise, do you think that we can lessen that scourge?
I think you
can. In relation to cocaine, let's take cocaine.
Well, you can lessen the harms. I mean, you know, if you're educating people, but also you're giving people these safer inhalation pipes. You know, things like that. You know, if someone's taking drugs, how do you stop them? It's very, very hard. You know, this thing about, oh, well, you know, if you take cocaine, you're buying bullets for rebels in Colombia or terrorists. I'm sorry, that might be valid, but there's such a disconnect. People aren't going to stop. But I just think that if somebody is caught with drugs, what benefit to society is giving them a criminal record? And to go back to Leo Varadkar, If Leo had been unlucky enough during his student days to be busted, he would never have been a doctor. He might have become Taoiseach, possibly. I doubt it. But he wouldn't have been allowed to go to America to meet the president on Paddy's Day. He couldn't have gone to Japan to meet the Japanese Prime Minister. But he got away with it. And that's why I was going back to the original point that if you do, as a politician, say, I tried drugs, yep, whatever, and then you're not supporting decriminalisation, I think there's actually a gross hypocrisy there. Mm. I think.
Damien is involved. Damien Dempsey?
Damien Dempsey is a wonderful man.
He is.
On so many levels.
So much so.
One of the best gigs I've been to in the last 3 years was the Christmas get-together.
Baker Street?
No, Cool Mind Therapeutic Community. Damien is an ambassador for people who go into this residential community, a range of addiction issues. And he goes in there, he chats to everybody. And they had a Christmas gig. And there's a couple of lads playing away who are amazing. One of them did Soft Cell, an acoustic version of Say Hello, Wave Goodbye.
What a song.
And after I said to Damien, I said, oh, he's your mate you brought with you. He said, oh, no, he's a resident here.
Yeah.
I said, oh, my God. Music is incredibly powerful, as we know. We did an interview with him, and he was very, very honest. He spoke about a cousin who passed away in the bath after an overdose. And the damage cocaine in particular has done to communities like Donnymead, where he's from. One of his songs is The Dirty Devil's Dandruff, which addresses that. He also spoke very fondly of Christy Dignam, who, of course, had addiction issues down through the years. It's a beautiful interview. And as I say, it's so human. And again, I think it's important because, you know, just hearing these stories, they're very human stories. We want to get on some bereaved parents fairly shortly. Again, we don't want to be exploitative. But I think what they have to say, many of them have come round to the fact that, you know, prohibition doesn't work. So you think that they might be really uber cracking down and imprisoning everybody. But often bereaved parents realise that, well, my kid wasn't a bad lot. They weren't a criminal. They just dabbled in something. And maybe there'd have been better outcomes if they hadn't been ostracised. There was stigma. I mean, so that's very powerful when you sit down with a parent who's worked out themselves that actually, you know, what we're doing now doesn't work and it makes things worse.
Damien's great. Just you brought back a really fond memory into my head of myself, Tony Fenton, and Ian Dempsey walking down, coming out of O'Donoghue's at about 9 o'clock in the evening, walking down Stephen's Green, screaming at the top of our lungs, "I'm busting out of here!" by Damien, and we're all, "I'm busting out of here!"
Oh.
Absolutely fantastic, and the apple of my eye, then New York. Oh God, I love it.
No, he's just the real deal. Actually, talking the music industry, the current episode of Dealing with Drugs, a Hot Press podcast, is with a guy called the Secret Drug Addict. Now, he spoke to us, you know, so we know he's male. And he worked at the height of Britpop for Creation Records, and he would have worked indirectly for Oasis. And he has a new book, The Diary of a Secret Drug Addict. And he set up a Twitter account about 8 or 9 years ago to offer non-judgmental support to people with addiction issues. And it's fascinating. And I'll be honest, there's something voyeuristic about hearing about the excess at Creation
Records. This is right up your street, Stuart. This is combining, you know, all the things you love in life so much.
But he made the point that, you know, they were taking cocaine, an expensive drug. They weren't injecting it. And they thought people taking heroin were kind of dirty and seedy and horrible. But he said, like, 2 years later, the industry changed and heroin became the drug of choice because people wanted to break that taboo. And he had so much fun on drugs until it stopped being fun.
Mm.
And he got fired from Creation Records, which is pretty hard to do.
Mm.
You know, turning up late, not a problem. Missing for a week, not a problem. But he said he went to the Creation Records Christmas party and didn't get out of the toilet. He was either...
It doesn't leave the toilet.
He couldn't leave the toilet. He was either being given a line or he was giving somebody a line.
It's like I was at a party recently. We were brought out for treats recently. We were brought out for a treat lunch. And it was one of those things where, you know, oh, go on, you're the stars, you can have whatever you want. So we were at the one where we were having drinks waiting for our drinks. We were brought drinks waiting for our drinks. Do you know that kind of thing?
That's the same kind of a thing. When it really stopped being fun was when he was chopping a line and a girl died at his feet. Now, he hadn't got the drugs from him, but he was kind of like, this isn't what it was supposed to be.
Mm.
I was supposed to be a record mogul. I was meant to be the Richard Branson of my generation, and now there's people dying around me. He's now nearly 7,000 days sober. And fascinatingly, he's best mates with Neville Southall.
7,000 days sober? That's 20 years.
Yeah. Well,
Neville Southall.
No, not Neville Southall. The secret drug addicts.
No, Neville Southall. Go on.
Neville Southall's never taken illegal drugs. Yeah. Can we just clarify that? But he's a working class lad from the Welsh Valleys.
Yeah.
You'd think he might be quite socially conservative, but he's not. He has a Twitter account with 250,000 people. And he has people on with drug addiction issues, sex workers, and the secret drug addict helps curate that. Mm. So Neville hopefully is coming on the show in a few episodes. Another person who is very actively involved in the whole addiction thing and would be a pal of the secret drug addict is Tony Adams, who has a new book. We're hoping to get him on the show.
Yeah.
Talking about 1996, both on and off the pitch.
Mm. So Arsenal won the double.
Absolutely. While he was, you know,
out of it all,
going out, getting pissed every night.
And blacking out.
And blacking out, but still was able to be an elite sportsman. So I'm looking forward to reading that book. So we're just looking for those really interesting stories. I don't want it to be, look, I'm a middle-aged man. I'm not middle-aged, I'm over 60. We don't want it to be sort of like experts talking to experts and to be an echo chamber. We don't want to trivialise things either. But, you know, there's been a few good laughs. Mm. And a few real kind of interesting moments. You tell your mates down the pub, I heard this thing about narco submarines. Mm. They go halfway around the world.
It sounds to me like the kamikaze dolphins that Pete Hegseth was talking about the other day. We're in the land of Alice in Wonderland at this stage. We're in the land of upside down.
And with those drug cartels, you know, it's trillions of dollars. So it is like James Bond. Yeah. The gadgets they have, all the kind of the gizmos.
One of the things you love, Stuart, of course, is when you were on my podcast towards the beginning of the podcast a few years ago, you were talking about rock and roll stories and you had all these sort of stories. Tell me, in reflection now, looking over the years, what has stayed in your head as a really good rock and roll story? And the second question is, are rock and rollers just not half as fun as they used to be?
I think they're...
I mean, is Harry Styles a great laugh, is he?
I mean, Noel Gallagher, Clang, said to me that they got away with so much because... The early part of their career was before mobile phones.
Yeah.
I think one of the best stories I was told, and I often use this when I say to bands, can you outgross this? There was a band called the Wild Hearts, who still exist, and they used to get bored on the road. And they would, you know, get up to various things. And their bus driver had chronic athlete's foot. So they got him to get a razor blade, chop it into a line, and one of the guys, when he forfeited, had to snort up a line. And then there was another band. I don't know if I identified them, so I won't say it now. Don't get you sued. They were going through Belgium, getting bored, which I think goes with Han and Howard being in Belgium. Actually, I joke. Belgium is a great country.
Belgium wants to you.
So they were on acid. And they went into a service station. Do you remember those, like, furry caterpillars on twine?
Yeah.
So they got those and super glue and gave themselves, you know, moustaches and sideburns and goatees. So they arrive in their destination the next morning, having come down off the acid, have to meet the record company and go into the boardroom wearing all this kind of... fluorescent caterpillars on their faces. I think that's quite funny.
Yeah.
But I mean, with Lemmy, you know, I did ask him, did you have to get sort of a blood transfusion? He said, no, but if I was to get one, if I required one, they'd have to take into account that my blood is some sort of kind of chemical paste now. It has mutated. And, you know, I said to him, I said, you know, you're a role model. He said, no, I'm not. He said, I'm not a role model. He said, I'd never tell anybody to take drugs. He said, but I'm just honest about them.
Yeah.
And he was telling me a story about when he was roadieing for Jimi Hendrix and driving the bus off his bin on LSD, you know, halfway across the country, which, again, because they didn't go off the road and kill anybody, is quite a funny story now, but at the time, possibly not the best thing to do. But he was saying that, you know, just be honest, and kids, don't take heroin. Because, as I say, no one has fun heroin stories that I've met.
Mm. I'm just thinking now, Bill Clinton said he didn't inhale.
That's what he claimed.
And Robert Kennedy says, I was 14 years taking heroin.
I know. I know.
How times have changed.
The Overton window.
Yeah, has expanded.
Has shifted. I think it was probably Obama, or was it Clinton? I think it was Obama, who said the biggest mistake in American policy over the last 50 years was the war on drugs. It was singularly. And we had a very interesting chat the other day to a lady whose name escapes me now. It's a foreign lady's name, Polish name, and it's just gone. But she was saying that all the, you know, America goes on about all the cocaine and fentanyl going from Mexico over the border, and they've been blowing up narco boats, which aren't narco boats. But all the guns being used by the Mexican cartels are coming the other way across the border. Often, the cocaine going to the States is being paid for with ammunition from America. Mm. So, you know, Trump goes on about all these people being killed on the streets of America. Well, what about people being killed on the streets of Mexico? Mm. So it's an interesting two-way trade.
Okay.
There's so much to unpick, and hopefully we're unpicking stuff that will make people think and maybe more inclined to go, well, what do the politicians say? One of the problems we have in this country, in Ireland, is serving police officers in the UK can and do say, this isn't working. I'm going to stop arresting people for using cannabis. It's a waste of my time, their time, everybody's time. Here, the Gardaí, when they're serving, they're not allowed to comment on operations. They merely implement the policy. I've had private conversations with a lot of very senior acting Gardaí who go, you're absolutely right, this is nonsense. But they can't say it. In the UK, it hasn't actually helped because Keir Starmer is another Just Say No merchant. He's intransigent. But the debate has probably advanced a little bit more in the UK and certainly abroad. Because
so you're saying it for the actual police on the street to have an input into the raison d'etre of what they're doing.
And I'm sure privately they talk to politicians and civil servants. But I think if we're to have an informed debate, they should be allowed to comment, personally. Just one final thing, okay. Actually. We're talking about Jason Q, the former Thames Valley top cop. He's done a fascinating piece of research. I won't bog you down with too much medical stuff, but there is an opioid substitute called Budeval, which in the UK, you get a monthly injection if you're taking heroin. And for that month, you feel fine. You're able to function so you can get back into employment. You can look after the family, all of this kind of a thing. And you're not absolutely going crazy every day for a fix. Here, people tend to be on daily methadone maintenance. Mm. They have to go to a pharmacy. Mm. Sometimes haphazard lifestyles, you're in full-blown addiction, you don't go. That is feeding in to the shoplifting epidemic in major cities. The Gardaí say that 33% of shoplifting incidents are linked to addiction. By introducing Budeval into the supply chain, and we're very slow to do that, there's various reasons, funding being one of them. It's a bit more expensive. In other cities like Dublin, this has reduced retail crime by almost 75%.
Okay.
So Budeval costs not tons more than methadone, but how short-sighted are we being? Because if you get people back into the workforce, not robbing, not going in and out of jail through a revolving door, then over a period of a couple of years, the state is going to save a fortune. Mm. But we're so slow. And then we have a Citizens Assembly. When they recommended another stuff, we went, okay, grand, that's brilliant, because it's what the government's wanted to hear. Here's like, oh, they want this. Well, we'll kind of do that. And we fudge. And you know what? We'll have a new drugs minister and he'll come in or she'll come in and say exactly the same things. Yeah. We did have a drugs minister. What I hate about, now, I'm cynical about politics. I think everybody is. But you see career politicians getting a portfolio, like the drugs one, because a certain party needs a minister from a certain part of the country. And they come in with no appetite or understanding for the job.
Mm.
And I've sat down with some, and it is shocking that they just know nothing about it or have civil servants by them. Yet it's not like Anna Reardon, who wanted the brief, understood the brief, moved things forward more in his short tenure than any other minister in God knows how many years, and laid the foundations for the medically supervised injecting room that is doubtless saving lives. Mm. So, you know, can we get politicians, please, that are fit for purpose.
And are at least interested in the job.
And are not wanting to be a safe pair of hands, i.e. do nothing. See, the problem is, it's not a vote winner. I don't know how you make it. And that is what organisations somehow have to think. Can we find some way of doing a drug version of...
Surely it is a vote winner if you link it to, for example, the idea of, do you want to see O'Connell Street and great streets like that brought back to former glories?
That might be the way you have to do it, rather than saying, what about these poor people with addiction issues? Yeah. Would you like to have your streets minus syringes? You know, it was funny because Tony, when he was with Anna Liffey, took me on a drug safari. And I used to see Jif Lemons at the top of laneways. And I thought, are people popping down there for an emergency pancake? But no, they were using it as a cutting agent with their heroin.
Yeah.
And once you know where to look, he took me up to Doyle Aaron, and there's one building with a load of leaves. And underneath the leaves, the heroin needles have been left behind by people with addiction issues to use the next time. And virtually any windowsill has a syringe. And when you start knowing what to look for, bits of silver foil, but the Jif Lemons, now I can't go more than 50 yards without seeing a Jif Lemon.
Yeah.
So, you know, drugs are everywhere.
Yeah.
Let's not kid ourselves. We're going to get rid of them.
Stuart, thank you very much for coming in and talking to me about this. The podcast is called Dealing in Drugs.
Dealing with Drugs.
Dealing with Drugs.
I'm not dealing in drugs.
No, okay.
That would be an entirely different matter.
Dealing with Drugs.
A Hot Press podcast.
A Hot Press podcast. And it's such an interesting subject. And you're about 5 episodes into it at the moment.
Yeah, and we're getting amazing response. We're going to have the former Colombian Minister for Drugs on in a couple of weeks.
Worth a listen.
I can't wait. That's going to be an interesting one.
Thanks, Stuart.
Cheers.
And my thanks to Stuart Clark for coming in and talking to me about drugs and politicians. And my thanks, of course, to Hum Finance for partnering up with the Mario Rosenstock podcast. Hum is a finance company who provide flexible payment solutions for customers, some of Ireland's most popular retailers. Thank you, Hum. And of course, thank you to you, the most important element of this podcast, the listener. The podcast is free. We don't charge a fee. There is no premium. There is no subscriber-led, subscriber special podcast to put out. This comes to you for free. So all I ask in return, if you can tell one other person that you enjoyed this podcast, let them know and follow us on the socials. It really, really does help. Thanks and see you same time, same place next week.
The Mario Rosenstock Podcast. Thanks to Hum. Finance made easy when you shop tech, electrical, appliances, kitchens, and much more. Flexify Europe Limited, trading as Hum, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.